Thank you. So yes, this is more intimidating than I thought because of the large number of people. But basically, what I want to discuss is trends in quantum foundations research that create epistemic dysfunction that doesn't need to be there. And so I'll do it by going through several examples of ways in which people talk about things being quantum features. And in every case, the way in which people talk about these things creates confusion, and I can prove that it creates confusion for other people, but it doesn't need to. So that is the way in which I hope to provide value for you, because I'm not, I have no reason to be telling people what they should be working on, but I can tell people how they can make knowledge production in their research community more efficient. So I'll just give some preliminary comments on my general research program, of which the overarching goal is to understand information processing in complex systems. Here we have some technical pillars of complexity science. We have Shannon theory here, algorithms, that is viewing systems in the world as implementing computer programs. State-space methods, that, for example, studying the chaotic trajectories that systems take through state spaces as you apply maps repeatedly. And then finally, the set of techniques that I mostly use for my PhD, which go under the heading compositionality, and in practice means process theories or process categories. And I apply these methods specifically to issues of causal inference. And so in this case, the complex system that we are studying may be the system that is modeled by our statistical causal model, or we may be talking about causal inference because we're trying to say something about intelligent systems that we think do or should be able to perform causal reasoning. So it can be either thing, and specifically I have focused on causal inference for networks of quantum systems rather than systems whose variables are ordinary random variables. And we ask the same kinds of questions, specifically of causal identification in these quantum settings. And using the process theoretic framework, we're able to give sufficient conditions for causal identifiability in the quantum context that parallel those that are known in ordinary causal inference. And the process theories allow us to also give parallel proofs and also parallel protocols for carrying out such identification. So we can see exactly how certain kinds of causal reasoning generalize from the classical to the quantum case. And now Ellie and Rob have seen some of this stuff, and they have started to figure out how one might be able to construct a quite general theory of quantum causal identifiability. So that is a very exciting outcome of our time together here. I'll just say, since we were talking, now many people in this room were there the other day when we were talking about catastrophic risk, I'll say that social epistemology of the sort that that I'm going to discuss here becomes much more important when we're thinking about catastrophic risk. And there's been a lot of study of epistemic threats to civilizations. Lots of network scientists know how to model the spread of misinformation in social networks. There are more complicated, subtle forms of epistemic dysfunction that are harder to get a handle on, specifically things that go in social theory under the heading epistemologies of ignorance, which are not sensitive to the availability or unavailability of correct facts. And so, for instance, you can get systemic risks that come from large institutions that want to They want to do things that they shouldn't be doing, and they may be run by political actors, but then what you get is that in order for those schemes to be successful and unfortunately be sources of the catastrophic risk, you have to promote this certain kind of ignorance among large numbers of people who actually do local decision making. Okay, so that's connection to FHI and catastrophic risk studies. Speaking of ignorance, as we know, is actually essential to scientific progress, right? So the whole point about normal science is that eventually we get to stop concentrating always on the methodological foundations of the discipline, and we can proceed more efficiently that way. It is just that when fields that have foundations in their name start to operate like normal science, then I feel like I should call your attention to it, and so you can see whether you think there is anything that is being organized suboptimally. Okay. Here is my first example, cloning. So some of us will have seen people complaining, particularly Tim Maudlin complaining about people saying that classically everything is clonable. So he says he's heard people suggesting that clonability of states should be the criterion by which we decide to label a theory classical as opposed to quantum. And he says, on the classical side, think you can clone the exact state of a box of gas? Good luck, where's the theorem? And we all know what's going on here. The informatic quantum foundations people that he's listening to are interested in the existence of functions that take in a value and return a pair consisting of two copies of that value. He's making the point that, as Nicholas Tay put it, there's a conceptual gap between the processes of classical information theory and those of some classical physical theory. The information processes of the latter are constrained by additional structure and parameters. And so we start to see that examples that I'm going to be giving in my talk, there is nothing about which anybody is going to disagree scientifically. It is just interesting to note that these people, so Tay is a good philosopher, and Maudlin too, these people see talk of cloning and feel the need to point this out. And so it is worth reflecting on what's going on there. And an interesting thing to note is that Tay actually did analyze what you can do with the processes of classical mechanics, that is, with processes that could be generated by classical Hamiltonian dynamics. And so the question is, can this clone states in phase space? And the answer is yes. And an additional interesting point is that you can characterize the machine system that's necessary according to how big it is. You can say, how big of a machine system do you need to be able to clone a given mechanical system, a mechanical system of a given size, or the state of a mechanical system of a given size? And so you can talk about how much of the state of our universe as a classical mechanical system could you clone? And there's a certain fraction of it, more than which you could never clone, because there wouldn't be enough left to serve as the machine system. So that is an interesting point to note. So I just want to say that if people think that it's more relevant to say that we can clone classical digital data than to consider these kinds of questions, which Tay and John Baez, for that matter, raised, it would be appropriate for somebody to write a sentence or two explaining to everybody why that is and how that fits into the general research program in informatic quantum foundations. Another thing that you can talk about is, even if what you're interested in is the cloning of digital data, you can ask, is it in fact the case that a classical physical theory allows us to encode whatever digital data we want in certain, usually collective degrees of freedom of its physical systems? And then does that physical theory allow us to force physical systems to act effectively as cloning devices for those things? That is an analysis that I don't see people doing. And so it's actually interesting to note that even after we decide, like I'm in the camp too of cloning of information is a pretty significant thing. But even after we decide that that's the relevant issue, we come to this funny point where we don't actually have a principled understanding of how it is that classical physics in our universe allows us to clone any kind of digital data that we want. So that is an interesting point of discussion, and we can pick that up later. Okay, so that's cloning, and the point there is just the most obvious point that I will make in the whole talk, which is that classical mechanics is not the same thing as classical information processing. And the only part of that that I'm saying right now is that classical mechanics is a much more structured kind of theory. That's why you have mathematical physicists here who are trained to study the mathematics of classical mechanics, for instance. All right, now we'll move on to Rob and Katya and others, quantum advantage for causal inference. So I take it that most people are familiar with this kind of representation of data generating processes. Okay, the idea is that we have two loci of intervention, X and Y, and in between there is some data generating process that we don't know initially, but we know that Y comes after X, so Y can't possibly be causing X, and we're gonna do some stuff at X and Y over and over again, and we're gonna get some outcome statistics, and we would like to know when we see that what goes on at X is correlated with what goes on at Y, we would like to know, is that because X is influencing Y, or is it because they are both descendants of a common cause? And there is a slogan that classically you cannot in general distinguish correlation from causation in a setting like this. You cannot distinguish just by passive observation, right? You're asking interventional questions. Does X cause, does the state on X, for instance, cause the state on Y? Would the state on Y change if you input a different state on that thing leaving X? But all you're allowed to do is passively observe what goes on at X and Y. And with that, there is a sense in which you cannot distinguish correlation from causation without additional strong assumptions in the case of classical statistics. And it is those additional strong assumptions that I want to draw attention to and question how exactly we should draw foundational conclusions about quantum causation from the results that Rob and Katya found. So now we're going to do a formulation of the problem that involves promises. So now I go here. So you're going to be now confronted with a comb like the one on the previous page, but you're going to be promised that the comb is either of this form on the left or of this form on the right. So the one on the left represents a cause-effect scenario. We see there's actually a mechanism F that takes in the state leaving X and produces the state on Y. Okay, if you get correlations and you happen to be in the scenario on the right, then the reason you're seeing those correlations is that X and Y are two halves of a correlated state that was prepared in their joint past. And so now this is still pretty abstract, and I haven't specified whether I'm doing a quantum or classical version of the problem yet. But the point is that these abstract string diagrams can be interpreted into, for instance, a quantum process theory And again, let's do the version with the promise. So we say, we're promised that you're either going to have something of the form on the left, where F is known to be a process of a particular class, or you're going to have something of the form on the right, where sigma is known to be a state from a particular class. Okay, and once you start introducing those promises, then it becomes unsurprising that sometimes observation alone is going to be sufficient for you to tell which of these scenarios you're in. You see, because, so suppose you are in the scenario on the right. You didn't know it. You got your observational data. If the class of possible F processes that you're promised you're going to be having is very small, then you may be able to check that your statistics are just not compatible with any of those Fs having been operating between X and Y. So you will conclude that you're in the right-hand scenario. So in fact, what Rob and Katya showed is more significant than just that there are some promises under which you can solve this problem. But the version with the promises is what I want to focus on, because it leads us to the question of, is this non-classical? Does this teach us something about quantum weirdness in terms of causation? And I want to say that it is not necessarily the case. It depends on, so if we're going to make the classical analog to this thing, we have to specify what classical process theory are we going to interpret our two diagrams into? What are going to be our promises about the class of possible F and the class of possible sigma? And so for some such promises, you will be able to do some inference, and for some, you won't. But now we come back to the particular case of things that are like classical mechanics, and we can say that there is a sense in which we could set up a classical mechanical version of the promise problem that Rob and Katya considered. And in that classical mechanical version, we will be able to do the same kind of inference. That's not going to be news to anybody here, but or at least to Rob and Ellie and Marina. But it's a thing worth noting, because we see in the interpretation of those findings, which were supported by very beautiful experiments done by, I guess, in collaboration with Waterloo people, we see this kind of talk in reviews of this experiment and statements about its significance. So here's what Curabella says about it. In classical statistics, knowing that two variables are correlated is not enough to conclude that one influences the other. Okay, and then there's an example about the schedules at airports, okay, and planes can take off at times that are correlated, and they're correlated by the airport schedule. But the situation is different in quantum mechanics. And so all I want to say is that this kind of language is what immediately is very confusing to certain kinds of physicists who don't understand the overall program that people are engaged in. If the physicist or the philosopher of physics starts reading this and thinks you're going to say something about physical causation in quantum mechanics, and then your examples are about planes and the schedules on which they take off and land. And the physicist says, what does this have to do with fundamental physics? Of course, the point is that in this community, people have already basically agreed that we are interested in this comparison of all the correlations that are possible with classical processes and all the correlations that are possible with quantum processes. But that's a thing that has to be said to people who do not already know that. And then we get the actual conflation of classical mechanics and classical information processes. So we have first here, like classical mechanics, quantum mechanics is a causal theory, etc. But the similarities between quantum and classical causality seem to end here. When it comes to the correlation versus causation business, quantum mechanics has a genuinely new story to tell. Of course, what we mean is that, well, the thing that we already said, but it has a it has a new story to tell with respect to the inferences that you can make in settings, in classical settings, with either no promises or certain kinds of promises. And I would say the use of the term classical mechanics here is just, is kind of misleading for the reason that we already said. We know that when we have a highly constrained set of processes that come from an actual physical theory, the kinds of inferences we're going to make are going to be much more. You see, this is an example of the sort of shift into a mode of operation that's more like normal science. We had these this very general approach that I guess comes from Bell, where he said, what we're going to call classical, or perhaps what we're going to call locally causal, or some other kind of feature of a theory that we're trying to test in quantum scenarios, we're going to have a very big class of possible theories, but they're all going to live, in my language, in this certain very big process category. Okay, and that's a very good thing for proving no-go theorems, because it says if you can prove that there are certain correlations that occur in the world that you simply cannot generate with any kinds of processes in my very big process theory, which I've labeled as classical, okay, then that teaches us something about how I could never hope to construct a theory whose processes came from my big classical process theory and was able to explain those kinds of correlations. So it is very essential for proving no-go theorems. The issue is when you start to just import that approach as the primary or only method for discussing quantum versus classical features, then you may run into problems associated with this fact that a classical physical theory, any given classical physical theory, is not the same thing. So again, it's good to continually revisit where these things come from. I think Einstein said something about how scientists need to be aware of the histories of their fields so that they do not fall victim to the biases of their age. And especially in a field like foundations, it is appropriate to revisit history like this and see under what circumstances the ideas that Bell introduced should still be guiding us. And I would argue if you're talking about so-called causal structure, it has to be discussed at some length what you're trying to do. All right. Now, so again, as we say, we can construct classical mechanical versions of these things in which we will be able to do the same kinds of inferences as we can get in the case of the quantum advantage, except that in the case of the quantum advantage, there is a genuinely quantum thing, which is that you can get rid of all promises. And you can say in a setting with no promises, there will still be situations in which you will be able to learn something about common cause versus cause effect. That's not the one that was tested in the experiment, but that is something that was shown in the paper. And that's a thing that I would say does not carry over to a classical mechanical version of this thing. So I would say, yeah, is a genuinely foundationally interesting result about quantum correlation versus causation is just that the quickest way of saying that is not really the correct way of saying that. You have to go a little bit deeper.
All right. Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So it seems to me, so I agree with you that there is a classical kind of analog of this quantum advantage, which is if they hear in a, we call it a symplectic classical theory, where not any bijective function on the state space is allowed, but specifically the symplectomorphic, the one that preserves Russell Bryant's background stuff.
Yeah.
So that, you don't have to think of that as a promise on it. You just say, well, you know, my fundamental physical theory says these are the only functions that are allowed.
Yeah.
And so that's part of my theory.
Yes. Yes.
And the one tricky thing is that over on the right-hand side, you can again get a restriction.
Yep.
It's just that that restriction has to come from an epistemic restriction. It has to be like, okay, I can only know the values of some Poisson commuting set of variables.
Yep.
And that's not usually considered part of the classical scheme. So it's a kind of weak kind of non-classicality. Like if you have some like a theory and an epistemic restriction, then you have an analog. And so I like to say this is sort of weak non-classicality sorts of advantages.
Sure.
But it's not like Bell inequality
violations. Right. Right.
So if you agree that the kind of the nature of the promise over on the right hand side, again, it feels like it's part of the definition of one of these epistemically restricted theories. So it's not as if it's sort of ad hoc technological, you know, it's not like a game theoretic promise. It's there in the nature of the theory. So.
Sure, sure. But right, it's there in the nature of the theory. Or I could have put it the other way. I could have said that even in the quantum case where we say we're talking about maximally entangled states, for example, that is singling out a class of states, if we're doing the version with what you call the promise. It is singling out a particular class of states within the quantum.
Okay, so that I think, I mean, I have to go back to the paper, but I think we were just using those promises to illustrate, kind of give a really simple example.
Right. Right, it holds in
those in the experimental analysis.
So
we targeted those in the experiment. So the cases that are really extreme, that's what we'll target. We'll take noisy versions of them,
right,
and then we'll prove that we can really distinguish.
Right, right, right.
To some extent, the possibility of distinguishing this just comes from the structural quantum view. You don't need any extra problems.
Right, right. Okay, yes. And if you go to the classical thing, then you could say, it's an epistemic restriction that is part of your theory. Sure, fair enough. And then of course the thing that I wanted to add about why your result is interesting is beyond what can be talked about with just the classical epistemic restriction is that if these things are open systems, then classically, without any promises, you're not going to be able to do the thing. Basically, because you can spoof conjugation of states in the epistemically restricted setting. So, okay, well, we'll continue with that later, maybe. But all fair points. Okay, good. So we have classical mechanics is not the same thing as classical information theory, a thing which we all know, but again, it causes epistemic dysfunction when other people read what is said by people who are assuming that we all want to talk about classical information. We have this idea that Bell-style, very general analysis and a very general stochastic process theory is good for no-go theorems, maybe not so good for talking about causal structure, depending on what you mean by causal structure. Certainly it is good for talking about what kinds of quantum correlations that are compatible with various DAGs cannot possibly be explained by classical processes compatible with those DAGs. So still, I would say it should be the primary method for what you guys do with your discovery of quantum classical gaps. But anyway, if what you mean by structure is a certain other kind of thing about physical causation, then maybe you have to be a little bit more careful. And then finally, I want to go to a third example and stress the manner in which classical information processes are actually implemented by classical physics. So Scott Aronson, who I guess is also a colleague here, posed on his blog, right, why should the universe have been quantum mechanical? And you split it into two things, right? Why not classicality? What's unnatural about classicality? And then once you figure that out, why quantum theory in particular? So this is an appropriate kind of question to ask. And there are various ways in which you could articulate exactly what the philosophical question is that has to be addressed. But the point is that people are now going to start to propose things that are unnatural about classicality. And one of the things that was proposed that I want to talk about now with you guys later today is this feature, this modular causal reversibility, which I guess Rob will know immediately what I'm talking about. Probably nobody else, maybe Ellie does. But this thing, special modular form of reversibility of these causal arrows for unitary transformations. Okay, so now people want to start saying that because for arbitrary classical functions, you may not have that kind of reversibility. This is a manner in which classicality is unnatural. That I just don't agree with at all. Basically for the reason that quantum mechanics is a physical theory, is a theory of, and especially with when you're talking about the unitary transformations generated by Hamiltonian evolution, you're talking about a theory of microscopic dynamics of closed systems. And so, of course, there are going to be many special ways in which things have to, various subsystems have to influence each other in patterns. Classical functions, which are basically being taken as your classical processes, because those are the things that we think more or less we can implement on computers. Physically, that's not at all what's going on. Microscopic dynamics is not at all what's going on when you implement a classical function. And so there is no reason, it is unfair to ask classical functions that we implement on a computer to display the same kinds of patterns of influence and no influence between subsystems that we would have with processes that are describing microscopic dynamics. And so indeed, you could ask for the processes on classical phase spaces that are generated by classical mechanical Hamiltonian dynamics, do you have these kinds of constraints on influence and no influence? And yes, you do. But because people don't really necessarily know what I mean by this causal reversibility, we go to no action without back action. So this is an elegant feature of QM. And to be fair, he does not say it is a non-classical feature of QM. But the point is that there is lots of talk about these kinds of constraints being ways in which quantum theory is more natural than anything classical. And I just think it doesn't make sense. So to be clear, what we mean by no action without back action, maybe I'll go to the blackboard here just for a moment. So we're saying there will be a process read from bottom to top. And it will have two inputs. You could think of them as bit registers. Okay, my process will be F. And the point is that no action without back action here means that if what goes in here can possibly affect what comes out there, then what goes in here will affect what comes out there. That's what they mean in this case. And that is the case if this thing is a quantum process that is, for example, a quantum controlled NOT gate. And when people say, which he doesn't say, okay, but when people say that, classically, not everything has no action without back action, they mean, for instance, that you can have ideal classical control of an operation on one register by the state of another register. So they're saying you can look at what comes in here. You can have an operation that looks at what comes in here, depending on that, does something to this other register, and then leaves this register unchanged. So they would say that's action without back action. And then what I'm telling you is that now people want to say this is unnatural, and this is a reason why classicality, yes, it is happening. It is happening. Okay.
Was this comment by Scott Aronson in the context of the type of things that we've discussed in Oxford about the difference between reversibility and causal reversibility, or was it just a?
Yeah. So he actually made some very important points with respect to that. Yeah, people brought up the causality program, and he made some very important points, which everybody involved in the causality stuff could adequately respond to. But there were again points that should be responded to. For instance, why are you talking about interventionist causation at the level of fundamental physics? Yeah, we don't need to go into exactly how one would reply to that. I agree that you can, but it was unclear to him and his other readers exactly what's going on in this interventionist program. And that's a thing that that Emily is now also writing about. What does this interventionist causal modeling stuff say about whether there is or is not causation in fundamental physics? I think that we all agree that classical functions as implemented by classical information processing devices have the property that they rely on external environmental physical degrees of freedom into which they can dump influence. So that's why, right, when you have the interaction here, you're going to have a physical interaction by the machine that's reading this register, okay? And there are going to be lots of constraints that you could find at the level of the microscopic dynamics that interacts this bit register with the rest of the machine. And they're just not relevant to our description of the information process that goes on the collective degrees of freedom in which we store the bits A and B. Because there is so much to follow up on about these things, I will proceed somewhat quickly toward the end. So I would say action and reaction is not a quantum feature. Everybody agrees with this. Things like action and reaction are also not quantum features. They're not non-classical. All these things about constraints on influence between subsystems have to be studied in a classical mechanical context. If you want to say that you're discovering something new about physical causation. So I'll just close with another example of a sophisticated philosopher who looks at the stuff that comes from informatic quantum foundations and feels the need to make these clarifications, right? So Joanna Luke says various properties of quantum states labeled in the literature as non-classical are non-classical in not exactly the same sense. You can compare quantum stuff with things in different classical theories, and the conclusions vary depending on the particular choice. And so again, my whole point is not that I say anybody is doing the wrong thing, but rather what she points out later, which is that the approach that people in informatic foundations choose is chosen more or less explicitly with emphasis on the less. And so it would be appropriate, since this is a this is like a seat of influence in quantum foundations, it would be appropriate to reflect on whether there are any easy adjustments that one could make to allow people like Ioana Luke and Nicholas Tay and such people who try very hard to follow what goes on here, allow them to see what it is that you're trying to do, so that they don't have to write, they don't have to make these notes in their philosophical writings. I was thinking about talking about what constitutes an informatic feature of a physical theory. I think I will not say too much about that, other than to say the heart of the issue is that quantum theory is simultaneously a theory of physics and a theory of information processing, whereas process theories of classical information processing are not theories of physics. So they arise, the classical information processes, of course, always arise from dynamics that could be governed by a classical physical theory, but it's the induced dynamics on collective degrees of freedom into which you've decided to encode your information for your own practical purposes. And so constraints on what goes on at the level of those collective degrees of freedom are perhaps not as relevant to physical causation as some might think. But we'll talk about this later. I think it's been 45 minutes or so. Yeah, I guess we'll stop. We can have lots of informal talk here, right? It can be like a good small group meeting. So thanks very much. Let me say something. Let me say one other thing. Coming back to things about catastrophic risk, social epistemology, et cetera, et cetera. I have to say, since we're at Perimeter, since this is recorded for posterity, I do appreciate that Perimeter is one of very few places of science that are known to take diversity very seriously. And I just want to say that diversity is a very significant significant factor in social epistemology. And when people talk about diversity in academia, there is a lot of emphasis on diversity as a way of improving idea generation. But I want to also emphasize that diversity can make social systems more robust to epistemic dysfunction, in the sense that when, either by adversaries or just by accident, social networks are in danger of being steered toward unfortunate consensus, the kind of consensus that's going to cause big social problems, or perhaps in scientific research is just going to lead somebody down the wrong path, you can bring people who come from other backgrounds, and you can make those systems more robust. They will slow down they will make it difficult for either adversaries or randomness to steer the network toward those kinds of negative outcomes. And I bring this up because Jim Gates has said on many occasions that he heard from Abdus Salam this quotation about when sufficient numbers of physicists of African descent were brought into Western physics, then something like jazz would occur. And one of the ways in which the thing that's going to occur would be like jazz is not just with the generation of ideas, but also with the robustness of the scientific social system. Okay, so I'll just close with that. That was it. That's my two cents on diversity and why I like perimeter a lot. And thanks to Ellie and Rob for having me here. I don't know if I've said that orally here in person. And thanks to the visitor services team, Amanda and Phil, and various other perimeter staff as well. It's very impressive how the people at the bistro somehow all learn the visitor's name after you tell one of them. And yes. Okay, so I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Isaac. We do have some questions online, so maybe we can start with those.
Oh, my goodness.
Doreen, did you want to ask your question?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Sorry, my camera doesn't seem to be working for some reason, but
okay.
Hi, Isaac.
Hello.
I'm a philosopher from the University of Waterloo.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Yes. And sorry, I can't be there in person today. I have a bunch of other meetings this afternoon. I'd like to hear some time about more about the normal science idea. But the thing maybe I want to pick up on was I worry about labeling the kinds of problems that come up in this, maybe especially Tim Maudlin's work, as epistemic dysfunction. Because it seems to me, from my perspective as a philosopher, that those are the sorts of problems that are with communication that are sort of inevitable when you try to take different epistemic communities, if you want to put it that way, and put them together. And so I think that one of the things to appreciate is that it takes a lot of work to have communication go in a way that's that works well. So I think from my perspective, one of the things that's really important is not sort of just expecting to be able as a philosopher to pick up any paper and just read it and understand exactly how the terminology is being used. It's important to go to talks like this and to do to talk to people in the community, to read other philosophers' work who have you pointed to some really good philosophy of physics work where people have tried to engage and think in a systematic kind of way about different approaches to quantum foundations. So I worry about thinking that the onus is on physicists or people in the quantum foundations community to just add a few more sentences to explain what they mean. And I think probably from my perspective, what's needed is a lot more engagement and back and forth and discussion about what the goals are, how the terminology is being used, that kind of thing. So your thoughts about that? I have one specific kind of question. So I taught a course this term where I had people come in, including Rob nicely came in, a philosophy course, and so we read a lot of philosophy work on reconstructions of quantum theory and quantum information theoretic approaches more generally to quantum foundations. So one of the things that occurred to me during your talk was the reading I used was a great paper, I thought, by Moroni and Timpson about it's called something like why is there a physics of information?
Yeah, yes.
So that seemed to me to be, and I wondered what you thought, whether you thought that would be a good paper to make the point you're trying to make about how quantum theory is different than quantum information and classical theory is means something different than classical information.
Yes, I agree with all of it. Yes, thank you. I have nothing to argue about. I am a fan of Timpson and Moroni and their work in especially information thermodynamics. In general questions of whether there's a physics of information. I would say that there is a sense in which quantum physics is quantum information, which is not paralleled on the classical side. I think that, yeah, I would say that there that distinction is much more relevant on one side than on the other. And because quantum physics is in many ways the same thing as quantum information processing, that's why we have seen so much productivity coming from this informatic approach. So I think I don't think the two sides are necessarily the same in that way. But yes, thank you. I agree with everything. And thank you for calling me on my putting the onus on physicists more than I should.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, I just wanted to take another.
Hello.
Hello.
Is it me?
Yes, hello.
Okay. I like it very much. I find it mostly very agreeable. The main point that one needs to be careful talking about, you know, when translating between different languages. And I have a specific question about a point you made towards the end. You said quantum theory is different from classical theory. Quantum theory, classical mechanics, is different from classical information, but quantum theory is both about quantum mechanics and about information processing. If I get that point correct?
Yes, I said something like that. And there would be more clarification that would have to be made before I would be happy.
Please make the clarifications.
I think that the main point is that the kinds of quantum logic operations that people would like to do for quantum computation, they are unitary transformations of quantum physical states, and therefore they are quantum physical processes on the fundamental degrees of freedom of our theory of quantum mechanics, which is not paralleled in the case of classical information processing as carried out in our physical world, which is always on collective degrees of freedom.
I'm not sure I understood this point. Can I think of, say, a dynamical theory, say, Maxwell's electromagnetism, classical theory, and QED as a quantum theory? You make the distinction using these examples.
Right. So, if we are going to use classical electromagnetism to encode and process information, the information bearing degrees of freedom in that case that we actually find in our information processing devices are not just all of the values of all the electromagnetic fields everywhere, right? There are questions about where there is current versus where there is no or negligible current. Okay, so that is a coarse graining, right? Whereas in quantum theory, so this is interesting, and that's why I say I would have to do more. To make this precise, in quantum theory, you do coarse grain, right? You don't encode in quantum computation your information in the complete configuration of all of the local quantum fields. But there is a sense in which when you choose your quantum degrees of freedom, you still think that they are governed by something that you call quantum mechanics, right? And you still consider them to be fundamental degrees of freedom in the terms of that mechanical theory, right? So there is a sense in which even the coarse-grained quantum degrees of freedom still look like, and the dynamics still looks like mechanics, which is not the case on the classical side.
I can't understand what you mean by quantum mechanics. I consider my course to be the degrees of freedom. I can cook up some Hamiltonian that describe these course degrees of freedom effectively. And I have a dynamical theory that's not the same as the original QED.
Right.
In the classical case, maybe I don't do this.
You're right. So you're,
I can do some.
Quantumly, your effective Hamiltonian is still an effective Hamiltonian. We still call it quantum mechanics. The theory this effective theory, we still call it quantum mechanics. The effective theory, if you want to call it a theory, of the information-bearing parts of a classical information processing device certainly is not going to involve Hamiltonian dynamics, for instance. Right? For instance, you have digital data. I mean, as soon as you say you have digital data, then you are out of the realm of mechanics altogether. Right? So your information...
Two points. I can see there's a sense I agree with you. Second, I can see there's one maybe I don't disagree. So I'm mentioning the second point first. I can, in the classical theory case, think of hydrodynamics. I can have a dynamical theory of the fluids, which should be reproducible by electromagnetism. I can think of the fluid dynamics as an effective theory given by some Hamiltonian.
Right.
And in that sense, I don't have a Hamiltonian. I do the cross-graining. It seems similar to the quantum case.
Right. So if it were common actually try to do digital information processing, no. But you're still dealing with continua. I mean, the processes of this theory are not going to describe digital information processes.
I can cook up a classical effective dynamics for discrete degrees of freedom as well.
Right. Okay. Once you do that and you do your information processing with physical devices that are described by those effective theories, then I agree you would be doing something like something that's analogous to quantum computation on quantum effective degrees of freedom. Yes, good point. I agree. But that is not how actual information processing devices that we typically use in real life are operating.
Maybe we don't need to go deeper into this one. Let me mention the sense in which I agree with you. Classical theory is different from quantum theory. This depends on interpretation. So in some interpretations, quantum theory is not just a dynamical theory plus a boundary condition. There's the observation or measurement, whatever you call it. There's something that's not reducible to the dynamics and the boundary condition.
Right.
And that need not hold for classical theory. In that sense, when I talk about quantum information processing, I need to specify what measurement I'm performing, the basis I choose. In that sense, maybe quantum theory is different, and that depends on interpreting, because in some interpretations, it's not the case.
Sure.
So I'm just wondering, is this the same reason that you think quantum theory differs from classical? It seems, I'm not sure.
I actually can't tell. So at first, it seems like you're talking about something different, but then I think harder, and I think perhaps it is the same thing. But if it is the same thing, it's the same thing in a very subtle manner, and I can't tell at this moment whether it is or not.
Okay, questions from the room?
That's about epistemic dysfunction.
Yes.
And maybe the connection to what you said regarding catastrophic risk and problems with, you know, political discourse and things like that. So it seems to me that in the field of quantum foundations, unlike many other fields, there's much more dependence on what stand you take regarding certain issues in philosophy of science. So what's considered interesting research can vary dramatically between different people doing fund foundations based on what kind of philosophy of science they prefer. And right. I'm thinking in particular of like the realism versus operationalism debate.
Uh-huh.
You have these two camps, and at the extreme of these two camps, you have, you know, the realists who think that sort of all research that kind of is informed by operationalism is somehow bad, and you know, the other extreme, you have the hardcore operationalists who sort of think they have to define all concepts in terms of operational tasks, and if you're not doing that, then you're not really making any sense at all. And it seems to me that my perspective on this is that quantum foundations researchers ought to be very good at taking on the perspectives of people whose views they're commenting on. Like that you need to, if you want to assess somebody's views, you need to understand what philosophical framework those views are framed in. And it seems to me that the bar that one ought to reach is that either you criticize the views within the framework that the proponents are making them in and say, look, that these views don't make sense in the framework that they want, or take on the framework itself and then maybe say, this is why I don't like that framework or why I think it's wrong.
Right.
But do not criticize the views and under the assumption that they make no sense, because if I try to understand them from the perspective of my framework, which I like, they make no sense.
Right.
And to my mind, we're seeing more and more of that dysfunctional kind of criticism.
Uh-huh. Right.
But I think there was a time when people in quantum foundations were less numerous, and there was less groupthink, and there was less entrenchment in philosophical silos,
uh-huh.
and people were better at doing this.
Right.
But what I'm seeing is more and more people just think that everyone must agree, because the people I talk with a lot are all operationalists too, and we all agree what's obviously right, what's obviously wrong.
Uh-huh.
And so I can just see that this is obviously wrong.
Uh-huh.
From my perspective.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I guess I wonder if any of the, what you were thinking about is an example of this, that, or not.
Yeah, so I mean, so I don't consider myself necessarily an expert in quantum foundations. That's why I, as you may have noticed, I really don't, I don't take stands on these debates. I don't take stands on what people should be doing, right? I just analyze the social mechanics of it. I'm not sure. It's what you described sounds like something that goes on, but I'm not sure if everything that I'm pointing at fits under that description.
It's maybe a very loose parallel, but the different moral theories on which people worry about existentialism, utilitarianism, traditional conservatism, and so on, it's a whole list.
Yeah.
Might they be rough proxies for the different metaphysical positions that.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
What you're saying makes no sense because I prove that 2 × 10^10 people will be much better off if you do things by way and you can take them into account. You do get that argument in the exquisite.
Right. Or perhaps the statement, rather than that it makes no sense, as Rob was saying, the line would be that it is not interesting research because it is not conform. Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
I do see a lot of not let me engage with this at the right level, but let me just point out that this is silly and obviously wrong, because if you're a utility, you don't even say utilitarian, you say, as we all agree,
right.
What matters is the number of people that are influenced, and this is silly because obviously lots of people would be worse off.
Right.
So it kind of doesn't engage the perspective at the right level. It doesn't say, well, let's talk about whether utilitarianism versus my opponent's point of view makes sense.
Right.
Just sort of interpret what they're saying under an implicit background.
Right. Okay. So, well, now let me add. So, I think that the things that I'm pointing at are not even necessarily examples of this. I would say that yours might be an improvement over some of the stuff that goes on, because some of the stuff that goes on does not consist in saying something makes no sense. it consists of not saying anything. And so then the stuff is just out there, and no one knows what anybody else, I think for people to say which things they think make no sense would be an improvement, and then you would deal with this problem, because it would still not be ideal, right? So first, let's have everybody say what they think makes no sense, and then they can say why, and then they can say why, and they can discuss their different philosophical backgrounds.
Pretty low bar.
So on your example of no back action, it did seem that it was not a fair comparison to think about a model where we have irreversible classical gates being contrasted against quantum unit derivatives.
Yeah.
Do you have either, you could provide like a quick list now, or a reference for like what you think would be appropriate classical analogs of different sort of mathematical operations in quantum physics? Like, what is the classical analog of the unit? Is it a permutation matrix? What about an isomorphism? What about a CPTP map? Like, some plectric transformations. Is there a, and it might not be necessarily one-to-one, but it could be like, these are the possible analogs. And so if you want to sort of draw a conclusion about genuine quantumness, you should show that like among the following quantum classical analogs, all of them fail to reproduce this qualitative feature.
Yeah, so I would say that the analogy should depend entirely on what you're trying to do. So I would not advocate giving a list, just giving sort of my preferences about what the analogies should be. I would say in the context of the particular kind of physical problem that you're considering, you will make different kinds of comparisons. You know, I think we've seen a lot from Dr. Hardy that these kinds of discussions about foundations are ultimately to be aimed at solving physics problems. And if somehow at the back of one's mind, the physics problem that ultimately is to be solved is there somehow influencing what you're doing, then that would be a good thing. But yeah, I don't actually believe in choosing just on my abstract principle what should be your analogies. I think it should depend on what you're trying to do.
That surprises me. Maybe then I could just like give you particular concrete examples, and you could say like what you think the analogy should be.
So,
the purposes of saying we've got this quantum C naught, it exhibits no action without back action. What is the classical analog that I should ask? Is there action without back action in the appropriate classical analog? So what would be?
So it still depends why you're trying to make the comparison. So for instance, if you are writing a textbook on quantum computing or on quantum engineering for that matter, because there is some, the ways that the circuits are engineered in order to have this kind of classical control is basically something that you just can't do with quantum mechanics. So if you are doing that, if you are trying to point out ways in which you're thinking about classical circuit models of computation needs to be changed when you start to think about quantum circuit models, then classical logic operations, or perhaps classical reversible logic operations, are fair things to compare to. But if you are talking about whether there is action and reaction in quantum physics versus in classical physics, then I would say that no kind of classical information process on discrete systems would be fair, because all of those things are collective degrees of freedom, and they're all going to be implemented, usually, not always, they're all going to be implemented physically by not only doing doing mechanics on the closed system, but usually also by dumping influence into the environment. So for that kind of physics type of discussion, I would say it's not discrete kinds of things are not fair comparisons. But again, I don't think that it's really necessary to come up with answers to this thing. I mean, it's fair to just state all the facts and use the facts for what you want to use them for. And again, I'm not here to tell anybody what kinds of questions people should be asking or answering.
I'm certainly happy to continue this discussion later, but it did surprise me that you pointed to this discrete property of cross calibration, whereas I would have thought it would be the fact that the framework of expressing classical circuits generally doesn't require reversibility, but if you subspecialize in reversible classical circuits, then I think now all of a sudden you do have that. You do have for permutation matrices, there is no action without action.
So that is a thing that has to be dealt with very carefully, because, for instance, if you take it depends exactly on your representation. So let's say we're taking the function that these will be two 1-bit registers, and these will be two 1-bit registers, and the function leaves this bit unchanged, and over here it exclusive ORs this. Okay, so classical C naught. Okay, as a process on the two bits, that thing has action without back action. As a process on the space of total states of the system, then we would say what you're saying. So there are those two ways of representing it. And
other okay, so we might as well do lunch with Isaac. Everyone's welcome to join. Thank you for. I think. Did you want to ask more?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi.
Just hi again. There's another one you made during your talk about interventionist causation.
Yes.
You said some people ask, "What does that have to do with fundamental physics?"
Yeah.
And I'm one of these people that have this question. I've been having this for a long time.
Ah.
I'm just wondering, is there something you want to tell me? Because it's totally unclear to me if I have a fundamental physical theory without interventionist causality, what I miss.
Right. Okay. Yes. So very good. I mean, I could just allow Rob and Ellie to say their thing. I will say what I think there is to be said about it. So certainly, considerations of Bell experiments, you can find something out about physics by thinking about interventionist causation, because you find correlations that so Rob is back. So he wants to ask the question: what does interventionist causation have to do with fundamental physics? So I'm just saying that in the case of non-classical correlations, the definition of a local theory that Bell is using is basically an interventionist kind of definition, and so we find things. We find correlations that cannot be explained by any theory of that form, and that teaches us something about what's weird about quantum theory. Sorry, that's a bad answer. Okay, let me let Rob because Rob and Ellie are the experts here, and Ellie was saying something before. So let's let Rob say, what does interventionist causation have to do with fundamental physics?
I think I'm going to disagree with what you just said. I hear a lot this idea from that you know, people who study quantum column models have an interventionist notion of causation. I think that's just not right. So I certainly don't endorse interventions as part of the definition of causation. Maybe there's some people in the causal inference community who do, but it's not necessary to think that causation is defined in terms of intervention. So I would say, yeah, even classically, causation is not defined in terms of interventions. Interventions are a good way of learning about causal relations. And they're also a good way of sort of building theories of causation. So, you know, I think that, you know, the Jupiter causes the tides on its moons, even though I'm not intervening on the mass of Jupiter, but I get to that theory of Newtonian gravity by, you know, building things in the lab and rolling balls down inclined planes and doing things where I do have the ability to intervene and see what happens. And so, you know, we build up theories of causation that have nothing to do with intervention based on evidence that has a lot to do with intervention, because interventions make it especially easy to understand cause effect relations. That would be my answer.
Okay.
More than it, you said.
Very interesting. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So I'm not sure how to interpret Rob's answer. It seems let's talk about analogy, like general relativity. The equivalence principle is important. It helps to live there historically. But then another view is that after we get the theory of GR, we can throw it away. We don't miss anything. We have the fundamental degrees of freedom as the metric, we have the dynamical equation. We have everything that describes this world, this hypothetical world governed by GR. The equivalence principle is dispensable. In the end, it's not essential. So what about interventionist causality? There are the fundamental theory. Is it this disposable notion? Is it true that it doesn't really matter?
Yeah, I think that's which I agree, that it is disposable.
It seems that you have some different views.
Sorry?
Because you said the quality is that you think it's something essential to our understanding of even the fundamental theory.
No, I don't disagree with what Rob said. I think we both agree that interventionist kinds of thinking are useful in learning about causation, whether or not causation is ultimately defined in terms of intervention, right? And so in the case of non-local correlations, we can talk in terms of interventional causal models and find out stuff about non-classicality. Possibly we say we find out stuff about non-local causation, and we did it by thinking interventionally, but it does not necessarily commit us to interventionism as our view on fundamental physical causation. But it's useful, right?
To me it's useful because there are doubts whether quantum theory is the final answer and quantum inequality is useful to understand the possible strategies to go beyond quantum mechanics.
Right.
But in the end, suppose we get the final theory, and the final theory is self-sustained. Then it seems, one view is that it doesn't matter whether we have interventionist understanding of causality or not. It's dispensable again. Do you agree with that?
Right, I think we would hope so, right?
Science for the rest of time will involve a kind of interplay between controlled experiments where we make interventions and, you know, hypothesizing about situations where we can't make interventions. And I don't think there's going to come a day where it's like, right, the randomized control trial is no longer useful to us because we understand this world so well. It's kind of always going to be there as an important, you know, part of the evidence we have for making the next piece of progress in science. So, yeah, I guess I don't see an end to the usefulness of, you know, intervention in the form of evidence.
Clearly, but
he said he doesn't see an end to the usefulness of intervention and as evidence.
Okay, I agree with that.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker. I want to especially note that.